it's coming back to what the lady said earlier with regard to benefit cuts, working class Protestant educational underachievement. Is there a feeling that benefit cuts are going to make things worse? And I'm going to explain what I mean by that. According to the charity Shelter, children living in rented accommodation are 10 times more likely to move home than others, than children that are living in mortgaged homes. In some of the most deprived parts of Belfast, such as the Old Park in North Belfast, 87% of the people live there in rented accommodation. If you move it to the area surrounding Stormont State, it's 87% actually live in mortgaged accommodation. And just one last point, the Education Minister made a very valuable point about communities having a responsibility for children's education. In the area of Ballymacarrett and East Belfast, school truancy is at 40%. That is roughly six times the UK national average. Some people would call it a disgrace, other people would call it a problem. But anyway, do people feel these benefit cuts are going to have an impact on children in the sense that their mums and dads won't be able to afford the rent? There are 19,000 people here in receipt of housing benefit living in private rented accommodation. Do the panel feel that these benefit cuts are going to have an impact?
Chris Little?
Families? Well, thank you for focusing us on those issues. And in terms of the welfare reform, I don't disagree with trying to make welfare reform easier to understand and to make work pay. But we need to have jobs available for people if we're trying to get them out of benefits and into a working environment. In terms of educational underachievement and educational aspiration, access to out-of-school opportunities, the Minister did make good points in terms of the need for extended schools, and we need the Minister, frankly, to give us the funding for Sure Start schemes in East Belfast to ensure that we do have those facilities available to young people to develop educationally. So I certainly recognise the need for work in those areas.
John O'Dowd, I mean, it's all very well for you to run an initiative that's meant to involve the communities more, but I think the point that the man over here was making is that if people are being hit economically, then, you know, you're swimming against the tide.
Well, let's make one thing clear for a start. The Welfare Reform Bill has not went through the Assembly yet. Let politicians and let local political parties use their creative ability to deal with this issue. And rhetoric, with respect to my friend down there, won't deal with anything. Well, if you shut your mouth and let me talk, then I might be able to answer the question. So you would. So it is. Yes, you're perfectly entitled to say, you're perfectly entitled to say what you think. You are perfectly entitled to say what you think. Are you afraid of the answer? Are you afraid of the answer? Are you afraid of the answer? What corruption? Yeah. Well, you see,
when you stand up for election, put yourself before the election.
I will continue with the debate because I can assure you, I can assure you of one thing. Right. Okay. Right. Well, there's one thing I have learnt in politics: walking out of a room and walking out of a difficult debate never solved anything. Never solved anything. Whatever. So the Welfare Reform Bill has not been passed. Allow local politicians, and I think local politicians should take the space and the time to deal with this creatively. And if we have to break parity, let's break parity on this issue, because the people who are going to suffer in regards to the Welfare Reform Bill don't give a monkey's uncle about parity. They want to ensure they're being looked after.
I'm aware that parity is a bit of a jargon term that's maybe understood in political circles but not elsewhere. That's basically, just for those who haven't come across it, the idea that the Stormont Assembly just has to fit in with what happens in England in relation to welfare, because if it moves away from it, there will be a huge financial kickback because we're tied in essentially to have the same benefit. So what you're saying is that we could actually break parity. Isn't that an enormous risk that Westminster would just stop signing the cheque?
Well, there's £3 odd pounds paid in benefits in the north. Let's see if how we can use that £3 pound cheque differently than what the British government is saying how we should use it. Because all the talk recently about, you know, let's cap benefit at £26,000, I know that one of the newspapers there in Fair Play Day in Paisley, it only would refer to one person in the north anyhow. So it's a sideshow in regards to that. There are serious issues to be dealt with in terms of welfare reform, but allow politicians to do that. But in terms of the economy, I want to throw this out. I don't think you can talk about the economy in the north and not talk about the border. You can't ignore the border on the island of Ireland when you're talking about the economy.
Okay, we've had quite a lot of talk about young people. There's a young person who's been trying to get in for ages, and so please make your point to them.
My question's for the Minister. How can you argue and justify that P7 pupils doing 4 or 5 papers now in schools that they've never been to is more productive than doing 2 papers in a comfortable environment that they know and have been working in for 7 years?
That sounds like a heartfelt question.
Well, in fairness, I've never argued that young people should do 4 test papers either in an alien school. I'm saying to parents and to schools that academic selection is completely unnecessary. And in regards to the conversation around educational attainment among young Protestant boys and indeed the Protestant community, academic selection is now a barrier to educational attainment in the Protestant community, as it is in the Catholic community. We have evidence across the educational spectrum of schools who do not practice selection and are producing excellent academic results. So why do we have selection? Because the vast majority of those schools who now tell us their grammar take in all grades and none. I have referred to it as a clever marketing device because the money follows the pupil. So these grammar schools bring in all grades. They advertise them as teaching some form of different education than the school around down the road, which they do not. So my argument is quite simple. Let's remove academic selection. Let's approve educational attainment for all our young people and allow education not to be based on 2 tests or 4 tests, but on a child's journey through the entire educational pathway.
Michael Copeland, do you want to add a quick word on that?
Yeah, it's probably patent to obviously everybody in this room I failed the 11+. Having said that, I never felt my way in any way socially or educationally disadvantaged by that. I went to Lisnashara Secondary School, and I believe that it gave me a perfectly satisfactory preparation for life. However, things are different now, and our son, we were told when he was 9 at his primary school, he'd never be able to read and write. And rather than put him through the trauma of selection, we took a decision that he wouldn't do it, and he was put and sent to Lagan College, where he entered in a class that had the disguised fact that he was at the bottom of the pile. But when he came out the top, he came out at the top of the pile. He was accepted for Queen's University. He got a 2-1 in psychology and has been selected or hopes to commence medicine in September. And I have to tell you that any school that can take some child going in at the bottom, having not or having lacked parents with the courage or whatever it requires to put a child through that at that age. For Matthew, the correct decision was taken. And I believe that that type of school where you have multi-talented children within the one combination focused on making every child be nothing more or nothing less than the best that they could be provides a solution. It may not be the solution that everyone wants.
Is that your party's policy, though?
That's my life story. That's my life story. And what John has said is right. If the school estate continues to decline, there'll be nothing left, only grammar schools, because there won't be enough pupils to fill the desks in them all. So it's a sort of a moot argument. It shouldn't be about social class. That's my view.
The lady here, sorry.
Going to go in a different direction here, but to see tonight everything's going to touch on finance. Every topic it's raised at the end of the day comes down to finance, so this question is very important. In light of the quest to move forward in a positive manner, can each individual member of the panel please comment on the reintroduction of supergrass trials, considering the vast cost to the public purse and the failure of this type of trial in the 1980s? Seeing we're talking about a lot of money here.
John Kyle? Yeah, okay. We'll try. Well, we'll try to, as long as they move it along quickly. John Kyle.
I think that progress and moving forward to a peaceful future involves people having a sense of justice and that justice has been done. I think in the past, supergrass trials have been shown to be defective and unreliable. However, there is an issue about dealing with the past, and we do need to deal with the events of the past in some sort of constructive and healing way. Supergrass trials may not be the way to do it. We need to look at some way to process the events of the past and move forward together.
Chris Little.
I agree with John. I think we've yet to come up with a comprehensive mechanism for dealing with the past, and we've put that on the agenda of the Assembly on a number of occasions and called on the Secretary of State to convene cross-party talks on this issue. I'd certainly hope that would happen as a matter of urgency. The Eames-Bradley report made proposals in terms of a potential framework for a comprehensive mechanism. It referenced the need for investigation, for reconciliation, and for storytelling. I think there are ways that we can come up with a more comprehensive mechanism. I recognise that for some people, justice is an important part of that process.
And the Supergrass trial?
Sorry,
and the Supergrass trials, you kind of addressed the past in general, but the Supergrass trials, was it a good idea of the authorities to launch that or not?
Well, I think, as I said, everyone doesn't have some people have an urge for justice, and I take on board that that's part of some people's request, yeah.
Okay, Sammy Douglas.
I appreciate Jane's question. For me, and I've met some of the families from the Supergrass trials, and I must say, I pay tribute to the work that they have done. Because my experience over the years, and I'm old enough to remember all the Supergrass trials, none of them worked. Because at the end of the day, we're talking dealing with people who were literally paid perjurers in many ways. And interesting enough, I was speaking to a legal person recently just about some of these Supergrass trials, the recent one. And he was saying, if this case had been anywhere else in the United Kingdom, it wouldn't have reached the courts. And that's my view on it. Should never have happened. And I know they're making a decision, the judge making a decision at the moment. Should never have happened.
John O'Dowd.
Well, I'm not going to talk about the specific trial that's going on.
It's obviously going on,
We should do that, right?
Well, you can talk about the principle.
On the principle of Supergrass trials, they're wrong. We should have learned that from the past. And what we're about now is building a new society. And part of that is a justice and policing system, which all sections of the community feel comfortable with and is not open to abuse by anyone. And as has been shown in the past, Supergrass trials have been open to abuse, and they're not justice. So if we want to build a justice system, let's build it on that principle of justice. Supergrass trials, that style of prosecution tactic is wrong.
Finally, briefly, Michael Copeland.
Supergrass trials, in my view, are about law and what most people expect when they go to courts is justice. They didn't work in the past, and I don't see any reason to suppose that they'll work now. In Stormont, one of the things that I do that I think is of some use is to sit on the Public Accounts Committee. And the questionable behaviour of certain members of the legal profession in what are called very high-cost cases, where a tasking master was given a slip for £1 million of legal fees, and he said, I'm not paying, I'll give you £450,000, the fellow accepted. They need at some stage to look at who's behaving and who's carrying on behaviour which is questionable.
Okay, gentleman at the back has been waiting for a long time now.
I'd just like to ask about the growing number of unemployed people here. It's ever increasing, especially with the people coming out of Queens with degrees, first class and second class honours, and PhDs, no jobs. It's very laudable for the government and the Assembly to have schemes like Dell and so forth, programmes of skill training. But I do think that the Executive and the Assembly need to look at many people in our community here who are in what you would call don't fit into that kind of thing. They're in the gap situation where they're actually not able for all sorts of reasons, psychological or whatever it might be, their lives are in a mess. And then belonging to dysfunctional families, dysfunctional relationships, they're not able to get out there to get a job and to go into training or whatever it may be. And they're just languishing. And I think that is a tremendous waste to our people here in our society. And that there's nothing seems to be done. They're just left and saying, well, you know, take your benefits or whatever it might be, or here's the training scheme. Many people are just haven't got the get up and go for all sorts of reasons. And I think that the Assembly and the Executive needs to look at, say, how these people can be supported more in terms of their managing their lives, managing their relationships, managing their families,
okay,
to get into a position where they then can get a job and can do their best.
Sammy Douglas said in his programme on the other night, The Lost Generation. I mean, is the Assembly able to cope with this?
Well, I suppose, I mean, that's a very good question. For me, we're all struggling with this. It's not just Northern Ireland. It's the Republic of Ireland, rest of the United Kingdom, Europe, the States, right across the world. So that's one thing. I think the other thing is that, for me, I think we can show a bit of imagination. And of course, it's very difficult for people to get in jobs, particularly that you know those disadvantaged people, those people who have particular problems. But let me just give you one example in East Belfast, where a number of community organisations came together on the Step Ahead programme. Not perfect for you know young unemployed people. Gave them an opportunity for 6 months, and because of the benefits of that and extra additional money, they got a half-decent wage out of the whole thing. And this week, I asked the Minister to look at the Step Ahead programme and to extend it, because there are some people trying to help those type of people, particularly young people who maybe had a background, maybe had been in prison or whatever, or they're just disillusioned, lack of aspiration. And my experience over the years is this. If you take interest in a person and try and help them, well, then you can work wonders. And many of those organisations, particularly the community voluntary organisations, are doing an excellent job in East Belfast.
Lady with the purpley top who's been trying to get in for a while. Or maybe I'm colourblind.
No, it's purple. Hi, my name is Mairead Collins, and I work for the Human Rights Consortium in Belfast. We campaign for a Bill of Rights for Northern Ireland. Considering that tonight's theme is regarding respond to the voters, last year, the consortium produced the results of a study that showed that more than 80% of the electorate across the parties is supportive of a Bill of Rights for Northern Ireland. Can the MLAs present tell us what you're doing to progress the creation of a Bill of Rights for Northern Ireland, considering this cross-party support from your voters? Thank you.
Michael Coburn.
I met with two of our policy people within the last 24 hours. On the topic of human or a Bill of Rights for Northern Ireland, I have to confess, having been out of the loop for quite some time, it was a learning curve. I do know there's a requirement for it, and I would be broadly speaking in favour of a Bill of Rights within the context of the United Kingdom initially, but with add-ons, for want of a better word, for Northern Ireland as required. I think it's a matter of waiting to see what comes forward and judging the proposals at the time at which they come forward. But certainly, I believe, having seen at the very bottom of the pile the way people's basic rights of citizenship aren't even really protected in really basic things like the right to somewhere to live, to be able to live there in peace, I'm familiar with the necessity for it.
Brief answers on this Bill of Rights, John Carl.
I think we all agree that a Bill of Rights is a good idea, but the devil is in the detail. And getting people to agree on what should be in the Bill of Rights is the problem. And it is a big problem, and I don't think there's any prospect of it being resolved in the near future because there's too much political disagreement on it.
It doesn't look like it's going to be put through from Westminster, does it, John O'Dowd?
Well, I think there's local politicians have to stand up here and be responsible around this. The difficulty isn't in the detail. The difficulty is that some political parties won't even agree to the principle of a Bill of Rights. And that, to me, has never been fully explained or rationalised out for me. Because if I use one example, the debate that's currently going on around the proposed changes to SEN for special education and needs children, and the protections that parents quite rightly want for their children. If you had a Bill of Rights governing the role of the Assembly and governing me as a minister, then there would be absolutely no question. I have to say, there is no question of removing those rights, but there would be absolutely no question of any minister removing the rights of children with special educational needs. That's the sort of thing a Bill of Rights will have there. It's about rights for citizens. And sometimes I'd be concerned, and we still have this habit in politics here, that if one party or one section of politics demands an issue or says an issue is a good idea, there's a habit of the other section to step back and say, no, we disagree with that because they demanded it. And there's no rationale or analysis to that.
And Sammy Douglas, the DUP, not very keen on the Bill of Rights.
No, I'd say that because I was met some people a couple of years ago, and some people from the Lawless Committee, and I had asked them what they thought about human rights. And they said, F all to do with us, because it's That's the Good Friday Agreement. Now, I think there's an opportunity here for education. And I see Sam White here, who's involved in the Lower Castlereagh Community Group, invited me along. He was involved with the Human Rights Consortium, with young people, raising the whole issue about human rights. And I've met with the Human Rights Consortium. I've actually introduced some of your colleagues to the First Minister as well. I think you're doing an excellent job, but we need a bit more education on it, to be quite honest.
And Chris Little, finally, on this point.
Lance Party supportive of a Bill of Rights. As John has said, there's devil in the detail, but I've attended a number of sessions that the Human Rights Consortium have hosted, and I think it's time that we try to find the areas around which we can have agreement.
Okay, and then we'll come to the lady here. And apologies to any of you who've had your hands up for a long time. It's a testament to you that you're also eager to get in. And if I have ignored you, then stick your hand back up again. Sorry, lady here. Yeah.
My name's Diane Dawson. I'm the principal of a primary school in East Belfast. And I have a twofold question, hopefully for the Minister. First of all, I have to say I agree with everything that you have said tonight. And I find it interesting the comment that 80% of education comes from the home. I am one of 10 children from South Armagh, and the 20% of that education that was invested in me at schools is what made the difference to me when both of my parents left school at the age of 12 and were unable to support me with any homeworks, etc., to help me with my education. And I wonder, Minister, it's a twofold question. First of all, how you feel then the recent cuts in education, giving back 120 million sounds like a lot to people, but the cuts are still devastating for schools. How is that going to affect that 20% that we are putting into children that we already recognise are underachieving? And one of the points I did really agree with you is that failing schools must be challenged, but all schools are going to suffer due to these cuts. And secondly, your last point that you made about the SEN review and about the needs of children to be protected. We already are facing serious difficulties because the needs of children are not being protected. When in my school last September, a child that was being assessed for SEN review, a stopwatch was produced, and that child's needs were met under a stopwatch. And my question is, how do you feel we can protect the needs of those children with SEN when the
SEN
review is going to be
special educational needs for
yes, sorry. The review is so much more severe already, and also the cuts that we are going to face in education when 20% is what is invested in the child.
Okay, John.
Okay, well, the issue of the stopwatch was raised with me during assembly questions by Michael Copeland on Tuesday, and I've undertaken to examine that practice. I'll come back to Michael in regards to that matter, because I found it somewhat alarming. Okay, so I want to follow that up. I'm under no illusions that the cuts to the education budget will be detrimental to education. And that is why, from coming into office, and indeed my predecessor, who, before she went out of office, said that there needs to be a significant investment in education. I have been working with my executive colleagues, and in particular Peter Robson, Martin McGuinness and Sammy Wilson, over this last number of months, and we have secured £120 million. But there's still £150 million still coming out of the system. So we have more work to do. So what I'm saying to you is, no one is of the view that the education budget is sufficient, and we're working to correct that. I think the additional monies we have achieved recently was far and beyond what I expected in this term, or this period of the executive. I expected further investment 2-3 years from now. I intend to work with Sammy and Peter and any other executive colleague for that matter to secure further funding for education going into the future. It's not a closed book. This is not a done deal. More work to be done. Fair play. We've done considerable work thus far, but a lot more work to be done to assist education.
There's a gentleman sitting with the microphone for some time over there.
Kevin McNally, Workers' Party, East Belfast. In the light of the statement that Peter Robinson just made this week, having just went to see the mechanical final, that it's no longer should no longer be a nose on the M society. Does the panel ever envisage that we might have a three-tier, comprehensive, integrated education system where our young people will be taught together?
Michael Copeland?
My son and daughter both went through that sort of system in post-primary. It wasn't available at primary, and to be honest with you, I don't think it done either of them a button of harm. That's a personal opinion, personal experience. But how can 1.7 million people have five different types of education? It doesn't stack up.
Sammy Douglas?
Yeah, a very good question. I was in it because Peter Robinson was speaking about that just recently, and what he was saying was that, you know, in the playground we separate children, and that's wrong. And certainly, I think there certainly is a mood and a drive within in the DUP in a very genuine way to look at all aspects of bringing people together. It's about reconciliation, but it's also about... And if we don't start there, and I think we all know the story about, you know, we're separated at birth, we go to... We're born in different hospitals, go to different primary schools, secondary schools, buried in different graveyards or whatever. So I certainly believe in bringing people together and reconciliation. But I also believe as well that the people have a right in terms of faith-based schools as well. And I look at some of the schools, the likes of American, who are doing very well, thank you. They're doing the best in terms of education and bringing people, you know, young people on. But yes, I think we need to look at different and more imaginative ways about bringing young people together within the schools. Good question.
And John O'Dowd, briefly on this.
Well, we have agreed as part of the programme for government to set up a ministerial advisory group in regards to shared education, and that body will be a challenge factor, not only to politicians but to society, because it is parents who make the decision where to send their children to school. But I think we will be taking our eye off the ball in tackling sectarianism if we solely focus on education and point the finger towards education being responsible for sectarianism. Our education system is a reflection of society. It has not created society. But I'm going to do all my part in terms of creating an environment where shared education flourishes.
Mark, can I just come in briefly?
Very briefly.
As part of a party that stood for integration from the day it was formed, I obviously welcome these comments in terms of shared education, but we've yet to hear any great detail from Peter Robinson in terms of what he actually means by shared education. I agree with the question. I think it is time that we do start increasing sharing and integration in our education. The Minister has advised us we have approximately 70,000 empty school places, so not only from my perspective is it socially right that we are educated together, there's also huge practicalities here in terms of offering the best education we can to our young people.
Okay, lady in the front has been looking to come in for some time.
Hello, my name is Michael Braith. I live in East Belfast. I'm here tonight to speak on behalf of 60 people, Northern Ireland Housing Executive Residents, who for one reason or another is not getting any help to get moved from our homes.
Whereabouts are you, sorry?
I'm from East Belfast.
But is it a particular area you're looking for?
No, I've set up a group called Northern Ireland Housing Executive Complaints.
Oh, right, OK.
And we've also set up Northern Ireland Housing Executive Complaints chat room. I just want you to write the name down. It's NIHE Complaints in capital letters. And I'd like you to go into it and read it and try and help the people on it, because there's a lot of children on it suffering. There's one child, a two-year-old, on a pacemaker. We wouldn't let her out of hospital because her house was too damp to go back to. And the girl has had to move in with her mother, and now she's had to go back to her own house the night the child took off her. And people are losing their children, and a fair lot of young children are suffering because of ill housing. I'd just like you to write, all of you to write down NIHE. NIHE.
Complain about
NIHE. In capital letters. Mm-hmm. And go into the group, which is set up on Facebook with 60 members.
Okay.
More than 60 now?
Yeah.
Well done. There's a gentleman over there with a microphone. Yes, sorry.
Joe Watson, a local resident of East Belfast. My question to the panel is, statistics provided by Belfast City Airport show that the number of residents affected by aircraft noise at a serious level travelled in just 3 years between 2007 and 2010, and is much higher than the numbers similarly affected near Stansted and Gatwick airports. What do the panel believe should be done to ensure that residents under the flight paths in East Belfast are properly protected by noise?